Live from Cap Radio in Sacramento, this is Inside. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. More than 3.6 million Ukrainians have fled their homeland, nearly a month since Russia began its unprovoked invasion. The majority of refugees are fleeing to the West, where more than half are in neighboring Poland, followed by other Eastern European countries. But a fraction are flying across the Atlantic, arriving in Mexico with the hopes of finding refuge in the U.S. Reports from Tijuana estimate a little over 300 Ukrainians have reached the California southern border so far this month. But this relatively small amount is also raising concerns and criticisms over a controversial pandemic policy that was put in place by the Trump administration and kept in place by the Biden administration, which allows border officials to turn away most asylum seekers due to the risk of COVID-19. To date, more than 1.7 million migrant expulsions have taken place since March of 2020. The majority are from Mexico, Central America, South America, and Haiti. And initially, Ukrainians found themselves facing the same barrier. But the Department of Homeland Security has now instructed border officials to exempt Ukrainians, opening the pathway for asylum in the U.S. But there is still a complicated legal process to sort through. Alex Tavarian is an immigration attorney based in Northern California. He'll be traveling to Tijuana as a volunteer to offer pro bono work for the asylum process. Welcome back, Alex. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Vicky. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we've been hearing about Ukrainians traveling to Mexico in an attempt to cross into the United States for asylum. What are you being told is happening?
We are told that a large number of families from Ukraine are certainly looking for ways to escape war, and they were happy to learn about this newly established exemption for Ukrainian families. So it is exactly what we hear, that many families are on their way, and these families obviously will need our help to guide them through this process, even though the process seems to be pretty simple when it comes to this pedestrian entry and requesting parole. Nevertheless, you know, these families have gone and through a lot of trouble and have enough stress. So we certainly feel that they need our help to make this process easier for them.
You had a meeting with other attorneys who are traveling south to offer pro bono work. How did this come about?
We had a Zoom meeting, which was truly productive. And we spoke about this situation. And I'm very happy to say that, you know, I'm not the only Russian speaking attorney who volunteered to do this work. And we truly hope that we will be able to divide this work between ourselves. In other words, you know, we truly hope that, you know, somebody is going to be there one weekend and then somebody else will be the next weekend, so that these families will know that Russian speaking attorneys, and not only attorneys, but also people volunteered who are not lawyers, but they were kind enough to volunteer to be interpreters. And some of them are going to be there in place and some of them will be there via telephone. All this help is truly necessary and appreciated.
Yeah. Alex, given that you're an immigration attorney, you help people from all countries navigate the system. What stands out to you about Ukrainians arriving to the southern border as opposed to heading to Poland, where the vast majority of refugees are?
Well, the only thing that that I understand from this dynamics is that it is probably true that many European countries at this point, they're really having difficulties handling so many refugees. And I think that's probably why the U.S. was kind enough to address this issue this way. And we appreciate what the DHS did. So I think that it certainly helps the European countries, because they've, you know, for the last few weeks, they've been really busy helping refugees.
Given that you've also been providing a lot of help here in Sacramento and San Francisco since the very beginning and really tied into the Slavic community here, who have you helped so far? What conversations are taking place now that we're approaching a month into this war?
I mean, the whole, the entire Ukrainian community here in the, mostly Sacramento, is providing tremendous help. And like I said, we provide our legal help, which certainly will be, you know, I hope, helpful to these families who are at loss and don't know what to do, especially when it comes to documents. But the community has been so active, and provided so many interesting ideas, which are being used. For example, many Ukrainian churches are volunteering on a daily basis, putting together some sort of, residences or shelters, if you will, to receive these families who obviously might not have, you know, money to rent their own places. Same way, some volunteers actually volunteered to even assist these refugees at picking them up in Tijuana airports, and also provide some sort of a temporary lodging in a Tijuana area. So to make this process easier for everybody, including the local authorities, who obviously do not want to see a large, you know, gatherings at the, you know, in the San Isidro border. So yeah, all these things are certainly helpful, and they're we're basically connecting the dots, and it works perfectly well, like a good puzzle.
Yeah. When we're talking about this exemption, we're talking specifically about Title 42, and that's the U.S. and Mexico border has largely been closed during the coronavirus pandemic. Where does that stand now?
Well, I mean, just like you said, Vicky, that this is certainly really helpful what the DHS did by making this exemption for Ukrainian families who are certainly in need. As to the Title 42, we all know that it's still in place, and we all know, you know, for all of us who really follow this issue, we see that President Biden continues receiving some pressure from human rights organizations who represent interests of immigrants, that this should be lifted. And I truly hope that it is in the works, and I truly hope that it will be lifted soon enough.
Yeah. In addition to Ukrainians, there are also reports that there are Russian dissidents that are also traveling to the southern border for protection. And some reasons are that they don't want to be called up to fight for Russia, or they're protesting the war and they fear for their safety in Russia. But they are being denied while Ukrainians are allowed to pass. Help us understand why.
Yes, it's a very troubling topic, to be honest with you, and I really appreciate that you raised this, because I really want to be heard, because I personally received several such frantic phone calls from people from Russia who feel that they're being mistreated or misunderstood by the local authorities when they try to seek asylum at the border. However, there were some incidents when literally they were giving back their passports by the officers, and they were basically told, we're not going to admit you. We don't want to admit you. You go back. And it is really, even though I do understand the political stance of these officers who might reject this admission, however, I truly hope that CBP officers will understand that these people, even though they're not from Ukraine, but they are people who also fight and run from this political arena of Russia and from President Putin. And these people, if they're asking for protection in this country, that means that they were also victims of political repressions, because they spoke against the war. They spoke against political prisoners such as Alexei Navalny. There's so many violations of, you know, human rights violations that many people suffered. And I truly hope that it will be just a temporary hiccup. And then Russian people who really flee, you know, Russian government will be able to treat it equally.
Yeah. I also can't ignore the reality that there are also people from Mexico, Central and South America fleeing violence. Haitians are still in limbo in Mexico, fearing for their lives. And they're watching others fleeing danger as well, but allowed entry into the United States. As an immigration attorney, how do you reconcile that and the argument that it is discriminatory?
Yeah, like I said, it is truly difficult to hear stories like this, because I do understand that even though, of course, today we're all our eyes on Ukraine, all our eyes on Ukrainian refugees, but we cannot be intolerant about people who flee Russia. And like I said, because they're also refugees, they also deserve to be heard. They also deserve to at least be given a chance to seek this protection, because they cannot go back, because Russian government continues increasing criminal penalties for people who speak against the war. For example, recently there was a criminal, the penal code article, which basically now states that you can be imprisoned for 15 years simply if you speak against this war. So, and many Russians, of course, are against this war, and many Russians refuse to be silent. And when they refuse to do so, they become victims of persecution. So I truly hope that, like I said, that they will be given a chance to also be heard and receive protection in this country.
Alex, before we let you go, you're going to be traveling down to the southern part of California in Tijuana. How long will you be there?
Well, this time I'm going Friday. I'm going to be working two shifts Friday, and I'm going to be working two shifts on Saturday. And then obviously I'm going to come back, and I am excited, and I look forward to see what we can do, and if there's going to be, and I think that there's going to be more work, I will be going back.
Yeah. We look forward to having you back on, Alex.
Thank you, Vicky.
Alex Tavarian is an immigration attorney based in Sacramento and San Francisco. He's going to be volunteering in Tijuana to provide legal resources to Ukrainians seeking asylum in the United States. Up next, a bill is being proposed in the state legislature that will allow parents to sue social media companies for getting their children addicted to its apps. One of the co-authors of the bill will join us, and a behavioral health specialist explains the impact this has on mental health. You can also join the conversation. Email us at insight@capradio.org, or you can use the Twitter hashtag AskInsight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. I'm Vicky Gonzalez. You're listening to Insight here on Cap Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. 4.6 billion. That's the number of social media users on the planet today, equating to nearly 60% of the global population. Among them are millions and millions and millions of American teenagers. According to recent surveys, more than 90% of teens use social media, and nearly half admit to being online constantly. For their parents, determining how much is too much is a tricky balance. While it can have some positive impacts, there is growing evidence social media can also be addictive and harmful to mental health. Some of that evidence comes from the social media giants themselves. Internal research and data leaked by whistleblowers revealed how much they knew about the potentially addictive yet detrimental nature of their apps. In response, a law has been proposed in California to allow parents to hold social media companies accountable. Before we discuss the bill, we've invited Dr. Andrew Mendonza, the Behavioral Health Program Manager for Sacramento County, to join us and explain why teens find social media so addicting and the impact it can have on their mental health. Dr. Mendonza, welcome back to Insight.
Great. Hi, Vicky. Great to be here.
Well, let's just dig into what makes social media so addictive. Can you pinpoint for us what it is about certain apps that make kids and even really adults, myself included, want more and more?
Sure. Social media can be addictive for a lot of different reasons. And, you know, some of the research that came out of Harvard and some of the other, top tier universities are saying that social media can be addictive both psychologically and physically. And what we know is that, kids can put out a lot about themselves and they can get immediate gratification. They can get likes and comments and reposts and reshares, all this kind of stuff. And what we know, just like if any of us have been to a casino, is that reinforcement, that intermittent reinforcement really makes us keep going back for more and more and more. And it's like, well, if I airbrushed my picture this way, I got 100 likes versus if I did it this way, I got 50 likes. And there's this constant kind of re-evolving, what gets more likes, what gets more attention. And that can really be kind of that chasing that high of, I got the most likes of all my friends, I have the most. There's really kind of that immediate gratification that happens in social media. Social media is a 24/7 operation, right? So you could be up in the middle of the night, post something, and likely, depending on what your follower feed is, you're going to get some immediate gratification from that.
Yeah.
And also, the other thing to think about is what also is addictive is that you can get such a large following. In the old days, you basically had your class and your, class of 30 and maybe your neighbor friends. Now you can have millions and millions of people wanting to know everything you do and say. And that interest, again, can be very, very addictive.
Well, Dr. Mendonca, throwing the pandemic, there are hours of screen time a day with hybrid or remote learning. And then there's also the isolation that takes place and maybe gravitating to social media sites and apps more than we normally would or teenagers normally would. How does that add another layer to the mental health? Or what are you seeing as a doctor with teens during this time?
Yeah, we are seeing some research coming out from the pandemic. We are seeing increasing rates of depression, anxiety, behavioral health issues, both in teens and adults, young children. We're seeing suicide rates are kind of bouncing around a little bit, addiction, use of substances, fentanyl, all kinds of stuff we're seeing coming out of the as a result of the pandemic. But, you know, related to social media, what I'm really seeing is a lot of more social isolation. You're in front of the computer all day, and then you basically after school or whatever, you jump onto your screen, your iPad, whatever you have, and now you're connected to the screen. And so that social isolation can be really physically and psychologically, really harmful, because really what we know is that kids need socialization. They need to be out there. They need to have interactions with their peers, finding out what worked, what didn't work. They're getting that important feedback and learning how to have social interactions that are positive and healthy. And that's important for developmental achievement. A lot of research and studies have said that, you know, kids that don't do that, you know, really have a problem, really lack strong and healthy social relationships as adults. So we really need to balance that screen time with outside of the house, off no screen time interactions with peers, with friends, in activity, sports, whatever it might be, because, you know, really, if you don't do that, you're really setting yourself up for more mental health and substance abuse issues, you know, as an adult. And really what we know as mental health professionals is social support from friends, spare time with friends, having that social connectiveness is one of the strongest predictive factors against behavioral health disorders in adolescents, teenagers, and adults. So it's really important to have that.
Yeah, what you're talking about, like human to human contact, is quality time. Is there any kind of room for quality time or any positives with social media that you see from your standpoint?
Absolutely. I mean, social media, I love social media. Sacramento County, we love it. We use it to get our information out. We use it to get information about our events and our services. And it has tremendous value in society, it has tremendous value to ourselves and to each other and to our connectiveness to the world. Social media, before social media really took hold, you know, the idea that you had to find out about a cause or you had to find out about something that you were passionate about. Maybe you heard word of mouth. Maybe you saw a flyer or a mailer. Maybe you saw it on TV. Now you can find out a million causes. You can find out what's going on in different parts of the world. You can find out what's going on in New York and in your own cities in California instantly. And you can really, you know, have a call to action. You can get curious about things. You can find out information about your neighborhood. Somebody's, you know, walking around that shouldn't be walking around. I mean, there's all of this information that is available to you at your fingertips. Now, good and bad, there's also some flood that happens with that. Sometimes you can get overwhelmed and get kind of paralyzed with this, all this information that you have to process. But absolutely, social media gives people access to information. You know, some folks I've talked to said, I didn't even know this in part or this area of the world even existed until I saw it on Facebook. And now it's on my bucket list of things that I want to go. I want to go and see and experience. And one of the other things that, a lot of kids I've talked to say is, you know, sometimes I just put on social media, I'm having a rough day, and they get, you know, some encouragement, they get comments, hey, hang in there, they get hearts, they get all kinds of stuff. And sometimes they say, you know, sometimes my parents work late and I just don't have a source of encouragement. And sometimes when I need some encouragement, I just put something out on Facebook and I get it. And so, you know, I think that can be really positive as well.
Yeah. Before we let you go in the last 30 seconds or so we have, what you're really laying out is a tricky balance. What advice do you have for parents to find the right balance for social media and their children?
Absolutely. The first and most important thing is make sure you're building resiliency in your youth, right? Is that, you know, even it may be social media, some other thing, is helping your kids have those skills, have those tools in their tool belt to understand and to handle issues that might result from seeing something on Facebook or having a negative image of yourself because you're comparing yourself against something on Facebook, is building that internal strength and that resiliency. That's really key. And the big thing is moderation. And I'm not a big fan of ban social media, shut off kids to social media. we know it doesn't work. And all that scare tactic kind of stuff, we know the research doesn't really support that. It's about moderation, right? It's about if you're going to go have a really yummy dessert, you're going to have to work out a little bit or maybe not have such a big lunch or something like that. Same thing. If you're seeing your kids struggling, they're having problems sleeping, they're having some mental health problems, balance that a little bit with some decreased screen time. Your kids are doing great. They're doing great in school. Maybe a reward is some increased screen time. So really it's that balance, you know, and really, you know, you have to know your kids well to kind of know that. And those micro behaviors are what you want to really pay attention to, both good and bad. And if you need help, get help. And if your kids are doing really good, ask them, what are you doing that's so good? A lot of times kids just want to be asked. They may have the answer for you.
Dr. Andrew Mendonza is the Behavioral Health Program Manager for Sacramento County Behavioral Health Services. Thank you again for your time.
All right. Thank you.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. And if you're just joining us, we've been discussing social media and the impact on mental health of teenagers. We're going to continue the topic by discussing a new bill introduced into the state legislature, which would hold social media companies legally liable if children become addicted and experience mental side effects like depression or suicide. One of the co-authors of the bill is Assemblymember Jordan Cunningham. Assemblymember Cunningham, welcome to Insight.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. Well, let's dive into the specifics of this proposed bill. Why do you think it's important to allow parents the possibility to sue social media platforms?
Well, we've seen in recent times, the Facebook whistleblower was the most evident example of this, that certain social media platforms of very, very large size have intentionally designed algorithms to addict children users. And we've seen harm flow from that addiction. We're experiencing basically a mental health crisis epidemic in society. Rates of depression are up, hospitalization of teens is up, eating disorders are up all across the board. And at least some of this, it's not all due to social media use or social media addiction, but at least part of it, I think, is due to that. So what our bill would do is create in law for the first time in America, a duty of towards a social media platform. Companies of a certain size, they would have to, if they're going to allow children to be on their platform, they would have to disable anything that would cause an addiction for those kids. And it would create liability for them if they don't do that. And then there's demonstrable harm to the kids, such as psychiatric care or something of that nature.
What would be some of the potential damages these companies could face in a civil or class action lawsuit?
The attorney general could bring an action, and also parents could bring an action, or guardians of the kids could bring an action on behalf of their injured kids. And again, the liability is limited to situations where the companies acted in a way where they knew they were getting kids addicted, and there was harm from that. I mean, whether it was seeking psychiatric help, whether it was counseling, eating disorders, depression, all of those things. And there would be civil penalties and the potential for damages. And really, the question we have to answer, and what this bill is attempting to give a solution to, is who is going to pay the social and health cost of the harm to our teenagers in particular and our kids that comes from social media use that's excessive. Right now, the situation is parents and the kids are bearing the harm. They're paying the cost of it. The schools are paying the cost of it. The healthcare system's paying the cost of it. And wouldn't it be more appropriate to shift some of that cost onto the companies that caused the harm in the first place?
If this bill becomes law, would it just take effect from here on out, or would it be retroactive?
The bill as drafted currently is retroactive. And the reason for that is this situation, based on what we know from the Facebook whistleblower testimony and evidence, at least some of these companies knew what they were doing when they were doing it. They knew it was causing harm. They had flagged child accounts that they knew were kids as excessive users, and they had indicia in their documents and in their data on those kids that those kids were having suicidal thoughts in some cases, having eating disorder issues in some cases, body image issues, depression issues, things like, I can't stop using this and it just makes me feel bad about myself. So, and they didn't do anything to stop that for at least a certain period of time. So I think this is more akin to like a tobacco litigation case where companies decades ago were intentionally marketing to kids that they weren't supposed to be selling to anyway. And in that narrow set of circumstances, I think it's appropriate that there be retroactivity. Although it is limited to situations where they can prove harm to kids. According to the whistleblower testimony, with Facebook, who owns Instagram, of course, their data is maybe 12, upwards of 20% of kids were harmed by the excessive use. And, you know, social media isn't all bad. I mean, if it's done in moderation and there aren't problems stemming from it, it's the way kids communicate today. I'm not in favor of banning kids from use. I'm not in favor of restricting content on the platforms. But I think when you have a product that you're putting out there in the marketplace, just like product liability in all sorts of different areas, right? I mean, you can't make a stuffed animal with a certain chemical that if a child chews on the stuffed animal, they get poisoned, right? I mean, we have these basic sort of protections in product liability. We just haven't done that yet for social media because it's new. And I think it's time that we take that step, and that will be a better situation for everybody. The companies can clean up their act, so to speak, and make sure they have stripped the addictive algorithms from their platforms. Parents can feel more confident that their kids that, let's face it, my wife and I, we have three teenagers, four kids. You can't stop social media use as a parent. I mean, it's just too much embedded in the way kids communicate, especially during the COVID period of isolation. In some ways, it's the only way they were communicating frequently. So we're not going to stop it, but we can put some guardrails out there, make sure the companies have incentive to keep it safe for the kids, and then the parents can feel more comfortable letting their kids use it. And then, you know, of course, watch and monitor and make sure it's done in moderation. I think that's society will be in a much better place if this bill and my joint author, Buffy Wicks, were also doing a bill on age appropriate design code that's patterned after a law in the UK that will create a structure on the front end to make sure that these products that kids are using are designed safely in the first place. I think the two measures together, I think, will do a lot to help remediate and prevent harm to children.
Well, Assemblymember, this is part of a longer or larger conversation and debate that's taking place. We've seen social media giants, Mark Zuckerberg himself, testify in front of Congress. Social media companies have largely been exempted from other attempts of reform at the state level due to immunities under the federal law. How does this state law or potential or this bill avoid clashing with those federal statutes?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a practicing attorney in addition to being a legislator. I hear that argument. It's Section 230 in the federal code, and it's really content-based. The reason they have those exemptions is because it's user-generated content that they're allowing to be on their platform. And it makes sense to a degree to me, although this issue is being revisited in DC right now, but it does make a certain amount of sense to say, hey, you shouldn't be liable for content that somebody else produced and uploaded to your server and uploaded to your platform. I get that. But this bill says nothing at all about content. Strictly liability for the algorithms that they are using to foster excessive use with kids. It doesn't tell them which people they allow on their platform. It doesn't tell them that they can't allow certain content. It doesn't regulate that at all. So I don't think there's any actual conflict. I think that argument doesn't really work in this case.
If this bill does cross the state capitol, you know, the finish line, Governor Newsom would still have to sign it into law. Have you spoken with the governor about this proposed bill?
No, I haven't had the opportunity to do that. I mean, I know his wife is very concerned with protecting children. She's done a lot of good work in that regard. I think I'm looking forward to having that conversation. We've got a long road to hoe, though, before we get it to the governor's desk. We've got, you know, several committees in the assembly and then, of course, the floor, then the Senate. So and, you know, I'm looking forward to having the debate, too, and working with the industry. I want to take their input on it. I mean, at the end of the day, if this were to become law, they're the ones that have to implement it. And, you know, I'm not trying to put them out of business. I'm simply trying to carve out a space in the law and put into law a duty on their behalf, because they know millions and millions and millions of kids, I mean, tens of millions, hundreds of millions probably worldwide, are using these products. And they just haven't. There's been a breach of public trust. I mean, when you let your kid onto a TikTok or onto an Instagram or whatever it is, you're sort of trusting that they're not designing that product on the back end in a way that is intending to hook your kid and get them to use it at all hours of the day, 24/7, selling that data to marketers that are, you know, marketing diet pills to your teen girl or whatever it is. There's been a breach of that trust. We need to fix that, and we need to impose a duty going forward so that where there are cases of harm, that can be remediated, and parents have a mechanism to do that. And that does not currently exist. I mean, there's no current legal mechanism. If your kid ends up in psychiatric care or in, God forbid, in the hospital or in some sort of rehab program for an eating disorder, I mean, there's no mechanism for you to go try to get the cost of that covered by the company producing the product that caused the harm. And that's what I think we need to change.
California Assemblymember Jordan Cunningham, thank you for taking the time.
Of course. Thanks for having me on.
You're listening to Insight here on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. We're back in just a moment. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm your host, Vicky Gonzalez. The scenes out of Ukraine are devastating, but unfortunately, they are familiar. We've seen them just last year in Afghanistan, when the United States officially ended the war and pulled the military out of Kabul. We've also seen refugees escape from the Caucasus, a region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea, after Azerbaijan attacked an ethnically Armenian enclave in 2020. And those are just two examples. We have covered refugees coming to the Sacramento area extensively, home to so many people seeking a peaceful life. Monira Sultani is one of those people, and her journey to Sacramento is a testament to the fighting spirit of people from all over the world doing whatever they need to do to make it in a foreign country. And Monira's case, she is paying it forward. Joining us is Hawa Sultani. She is Monira's daughter. She helps her mom run the Crest Cafe in Sacramento and the newly opened Crest Cafe in Elk Grove. Hawa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, starting off, if you could just please give us a brief background on how your mom and your dad ended up in Sacramento as refugees from Afghanistan.
Yeah, I mean, that's a long story for sure, but the shorter version of it is that during the Soviet war between Russia and Afghanistan, my parents basically had to flee the country overnight. And my father was lucky to come out to America, and my mom ended up in Pakistan. Shortly after, a year later, they got married, and my mom came out to Louisiana with my father, and they ended up moving to New York. And I came in the picture, so I'm actually born here in the States. But, you know, typical refugee lifestyle, you know, my father was working, you know, both of them barely knew any English. He was able to take any hard labor jobs he could get, especially in the city of New York. And my mom, she was a stay-at-home mom for so, so long. It just happened around, I want to say, 2003, when my father had to transfer over his job out to California. He ended up working his way up into IT. And my mom's family was already based in Sacramento. So we ended up going from Queens, New York, this busy, busy city, out to Sacramento. It was such a different change of environment for sure. But we moved out here since 2003 and been here ever since.
Yeah. And now you're here. Your mom is the owner of Crest Cafe, a woman that owns a business, but also helping other women, specifically women who are refugees. How did that come about?
Yeah, so funny story. Back in 2009 and 2010, my family kind of had this interest in potentially purchasing a business. And this is the time of the recession. So I don't really know who's given them financial advice, but it was probably the worst time to buy any sort of businesses at that time. However, my dad had always seen my mom have this passion for food. And so my mom, when she was in Afghanistan, her goal was to go into journalism or go into medical school. So she didn't get a chance to really finish her university there. And when you're a refugee and you come to the States, all that goes to zero. You know, like, you're starting a whole new life. It's clicking the reset button. But being a stay-at-home mom and, you know, having the TV access, so Food Network kind of became her friend. And so she loves creating stuff in the kitchen. And it just happened around 2010. My father leased the location in downtown Sacramento on K Street, Crest Cafe, and gave the keys to my mom and was like, here you go. Good luck. You know, this is yours. And my mom was like, "This, you're crazy. There's no way I can run this business. You know, there's language barriers. I don't know anything about how to run a restaurant." And, you know, trial and error, things were rough the first year or two, but we were able to kind of build up the restaurant. And we've been there for 12 years now. And it's interesting because it just happened that, you know, the people that we ended up hiring in the beginning, you know, all sorts of different help we can get just to help us get the business standing. But it just turned out that there were more and more refugees pouring into the city of Sacramento, specifically from Afghanistan. And they kind of knew about my mom, or they knew about the restaurant through catering and through events. And so they would come to my mom, hey, I need a job. And now we're primarily mostly Afghan refugees, mostly women. A lot of these women are either single moms, they have children, or they are the main fit person that brings in the income from the for the house. And so both of these, all these women that work for my mom, it just, I can see my mom seeing her own story in them and being able to kind of help them overcome the challenges of language barrier, not having a job, becoming financially independent and raising kids and running away from PTSD and a country that's kind of going through war. And, you know, here we are 12 years later. And we have a great community of employees.
I imagine your mom, I mean, sees herself in the refugees that she is helping, especially from Afghanistan and especially following the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan. How was that time for her last fall?
It was really painful as a child of refugee parents to watch them see this happen again in such a short time period. And I think what hurt the most, based off of what they say, both my parents, is that back in, you know, during the Soviet, there was limited media attention, right? Whether it was technology or whatever the situation was. But now there's social media and there is viral videos on Facebook, on Instagram, and all these different platforms of human just trying to escape a country that is falling apart overnight. And the world kind of sat quiet. And for my mom, she says it hurts so much more this time because this, you have evidence and you see it and no one's saying anything or doing anything about it. And we have family ourselves that are in Afghanistan, that are still in Afghanistan, that couldn't get away. So it was really difficult. And, you know, there isn't much we can do. But what was really amazing that the Afghans that were able to escape it over the fall, we've actually been able to hire a few of them and really help them transition into that life of, you know, setting up in a life in America. And so, you know, it's kind of taking the sourest lemons that life give you and trying to make them the best out of it. And that's what we've done.
Oh, that's wonderful, because you're not only providing employment, you're building community, you're building new opportunity and a fresh start. How does that shape your family?
When it comes to my family, it's, I think it creates this strong bond, right? Most people think Crest Cafe is a family business where it's my father and my mom and everyone else involved, but it's really not. It's primarily my mother, and I've kind of stepped in the past few years to really help them expand and open up this second location. But people can feel like it is a family when you enter in the restaurant because of the employees that have been there for 10 plus years. And you get this, you know, family environment vibe off of them. And I think that really demonstrates us who we are as individuals and our willingness to kind of help for our community members to do better and kind of, you know, have a better life here in America, even though they have this trauma that they're carrying and there's limited resources for them.
Well, given that March, of course, is Women's History Month, your mom has made it a priority to hire mainly women. What do you want people to know about your restaurants and what they symbolize?
I want people to know that Crest Cafe is more than a modern Mediterranean restaurant. That's what we call ourselves because we have such unique Greek food items. You know, we have the Mediterranean nachos, we have falafel tacos, and that's so, so different. But I think it's what probably has kept us in business for so long. And, you know, aside from the great food and the great quality and the awesome service you get, we really try to be community leaders and become more than just a business that's here for profit. For us to open up a second business right after the pandemic, the restaurant industry is really hurting. We're still hurting. It's really hard to get employees to come on board. It's the reason why we even decided to expand it was really because we knew that there was going to be a larger refugee community coming in, and we wanted to help and support them and continue that mission of really making the world a better place. And then that's our slogan, and that's who we are. We're here about, you know, just helping others, and food is kind of the motivator and the drive and the passion. But we're more than just a restaurant. You know, we're here to help.
Yeah. Yeah. The food is a reflection of your values.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Hawa Soltani, with the Crest Cafe in Sacramento and the new location in Elk Grove, give your best, our best, to your mom and family.
Will do. Thank you so much for having me.
And thank you for sharing your story. That is it for Insight today. You can learn more about our guests at capradio.org/insight. You can also subscribe to the Insight podcast. Thank you to producers Cynthia Lopez and Nick Dobis, with managing editor Aram Sarkissian. Our digital team is Chris Hagen, Emily Zentner, Helga Salinas, and Megan Minata. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones, and our engineer Antonio Munez. Joe Barr is Cap Radio's chief content officer. And I'm Vicki Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us. We'll catch you back here tomorrow.